Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. In this episode, we look at new research on potassium optimization in patients with defibrillators, reducing antihypertensive therapy in nursing homes, an mRNA influenza vaccine, and belzutifan for rare neuroendocrine tumors. We review long QT syndrome and present a case of abnormal behavior and seizures in a young man. We also explore perspectives on primary care reform, tobacco cessation in HIV and tuberculosis care, corporate control in healthcare, and the simple power of compassion with ice cream. In our latest clinical decisions, a man was hospitalized for uncomplicated diverticulitis and was found to have high blood pressure. One essay supports watchful waiting, and the other essay recommends inpatient treatment of the high blood pressure. What would you choose? Visit nejm.org to vote. Increasing the potassium level in patients at high risk for ventricular arrhythmias by Christian Jons from the Rigshospitalet, University of Copenhagen, Denmark, and co-authors. Hypokalemia and even low normal plasma potassium levels increase the risk of ventricular arrhythmias among patients with cardiovascular disease. An assessment of a strategy of actively increasing plasma potassium levels to the high normal range has been needed. This trial in Denmark enrolled 1,200 participants at high risk for ventricular arrhythmias, defined as those with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, ICD, and with a baseline plasma potassium level of 4.3 millimoles per liter or lower. Participants were randomly assigned to a treatment regimen aimed at increasing the plasma potassium level to a high normal level, 4.5 to 5 millimoles per liter, by means of potassium supplementation, a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, or both, plus dietary guidance and standard care, or to standard care only. Among these participants, a treatment-induced increase in plasma potassium levels led to a significantly lower risk of appropriate ICD therapy, that is, shock therapy or anti-tachycardia pacing, unplanned hospitalization for arrhythmia or heart failure, or death from any cause as compared with standard care. Neil Chatterjee from the University of Washington, Seattle, writes in an editorial that a long-recognized and potentially modifiable risk factor for ventricular arrhythmias is hypokalemia. In the trial by Jons and co-authors, targeting a high normal potassium level led to a significantly lower risk of clinically meaningful arrhythmias and death than standard care. These findings support aiming to increase the potassium to a high normal level in persons with ICDs at high risk for ventricular arrhythmia. But the safety of such intervention in a real-world context should be viewed with caution. Strategies to maintain a high normal potassium level deserve a place in the toolbox to prevent ventricular arrhythmias in high-risk patients with ICDs. In clinical practice, this means close attention to potassium levels, awareness of precipitants of hypokalemia, and consideration of potassium-raising measures in such patients. In an era of increasing diagnostic and therapeutic complexity, this trial shows that seemingly small electrolyte adjustments can have a big clinical benefit in the right patients. Reduction of antihypertensive treatment in nursing home residents by Athanase Benetos from the Université de Lorraine, Nancy, France, and co-authors. Older patients with hypertension are at high risk for cardiovascular complications. Owing to this increased risk, such patients may derive substantial benefits from antihypertensive drugs. However, randomized clinical trials have generally excluded patients with clinically significant frailty, who are more likely than other patients of similar ages to have adverse effects from antihypertensive drugs. In this trial conducted in France, 1,048 nursing home residents 80 years of age or older who were receiving more than one antihypertensive drug and had a systolic blood pressure below 130 millimeters of mercury were randomly assigned to a protocol-driven strategy of progressive reduction of antihypertensive treatment, step-down group, or to receive usual care. Patients were to be followed for up to 4 years. The antihypertensive treatment step-down strategy did not lead to lower all-cause mortality than usual care. Efficacy, immunogenicity, and safety of a modified mRNA influenza vaccine by David Fitzpatrick from the East West Medical Research Institute, Honolulu, and co-authors. Influenza remains a major health burden despite the use of licensed vaccines. Nucleoside-modified messenger RNA, modRNA, influenza vaccines have shown promising immunogenicity against influenza and an acceptable safety profile in a Phase 1-2 trial. In this Phase 3 trial, conducted in the United States, South Africa, and the Philippines, 18,476 healthy adults between the ages of 18 and 64 years were randomly assigned to receive either a quadrivalent modRNA influenza vaccine or a licensed inactivated quadrivalent influenza vaccine control group during the 2022 to 2023 influenza season. The relative efficacy of the modRNA vaccine was 34.5% greater than the control vaccine against influenza-like illness, a finding that met the criteria for both non-inferiority and superiority. The modRNA vaccine elicited greater immune responses to AH3N2 and AH1N1 strains, but was associated with more reactogenicity events. Hanna El-Sali and Robert Atmar from Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, write that annual influenza vaccination campaigns are a trusted tool in efforts to decrease the morbidity and mortality of influenza in the United States, with an effectiveness of 36-54% at preventing influenza-related outpatient medical visits and 41-55% at preventing influenza-related hospitalizations in adults during the most recent 2024 to 2025 season. Short of developing a universal influenza vaccine, the development of seasonal influenza vaccines with improved effectiveness would constitute an important public health advance. In the trial by Fitzpatrick and co-authors, the quadrivalent modRNA vaccine was more efficacious than the control vaccine at preventing virologically confirmed influenza-like illness. The modRNA vaccine elicited better antibody responses against influenza A, but lower responses against influenza B viruses. No major safety concerns were identified, though the percentages of modRNA recipients who reported chills, myalgia, or fever were 3 times as high as those of recipients of the control vaccine. The enhanced modRNA vaccine protection against influenza A viruses in young adults appears to be a step forward, but much remains to be achieved before enlisting mRNA vaccines in the annual fight against influenza. Belzutifan for advanced pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma by Camilo Jimenez from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, and co-authors. Pheochromocytoma and paraganglioma are neoplasms originating in the adrenal medulla and extra-adrenal paraganglia, respectively. Patients with pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma face substantial health challenges associated with tumor burden, cardiovascular complications related to hypertension, and gastrointestinal symptoms such as constipation due to catecholamine excess. Though malignancy is rare in such tumors, most cases of metastatic pheochromocytoma and paraganglioma are driven by dysregulation of the hypoxia-inducible factor 2-alpha, HIF-2-alpha pathway. Belzutifan is an HIF-2-alpha inhibitor that may provide anti-tumor activity in patients with these neoplasms. This Phase 2 single-group trial involved 72 participants with locally advanced or metastatic pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma that was not amenable to surgery or curative intent treatment. Participants received oral daily belzutifan until the occurrence of progression, unacceptable toxic effects, or withdrawal from the trial. Belzutifan showed anti-tumor activity with durable responses in these participants. Long QT syndrome, a review article by Peter Schwartz and Leah Crotti from the Istituto Oxilogico Italiano, IRCCS, Milan. Long QT syndrome is a leading cause of sudden death in young persons, with a prevalence exceeding 1 in 2,000. It is characterized by prolongation of the QT interval, aberrant T-wave morphologic features, and a propensity toward life-threatening arrhythmias triggered mostly by adrenergic activation. Long QT syndrome is caused by variants in genes encoding primarily for potassium ion and sodium ion channels. Common genetic variants in modifier genes increase or decrease the arrhythmic risk linked to the disease-causing variants and can contribute to risk stratification. The current therapies, including treatment with beta blockers, left cardiac sympathetic denervation, and mexiletine, are extremely effective and limit the need for an implantable cardioverter defibrillator to a small percentage of patients. Genotype-specific management is important. Gene therapy is promising but is not yet ready for clinical use. Arrhythmic risk and the approach to therapy need to be reassessed at yearly visits to allow optimization of therapy. A 27-year-old man with abnormal behaviors, confusion, and seizure. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Nadia Kihihe and colleagues. A 27-year-old man with bipolar 1 disorder was admitted for abnormal behaviors and confusion that had developed over 2 months after he had stopped his psychiatric medications. He appeared disoriented, paranoid, and spoke in nonsensical, tangential statements. At the time of admission, the patient was taking no medications, but had previously received prescriptions for lithium carbonate, propranolol, bupropion, clonazepam, buspirone, and gabapentin. During hospitalization, he had a tonic-clonic seizure. Examination revealed tachycardia, restlessness, and an unsteady gait. Laboratory studies showed leukocytosis, ketonuria, and mild proteinuria. Findings on EEG, MRI, and cerebrospinal fluid analysis were normal. Multiple features of this patient's case were consistent with a diagnosis of thyrotoxicosis, including the duration of his illness, the presence of maniform symptoms and cognitive impairment, persistent sinus tachycardia, and seizure, a rare finding. Thyroid testing revealed a thyrotropin level of less than 0.1 milli international units per liter, a total thyroxine level of 21.2 micrograms per deciliter, and a free thyroxine level of 3.7 nanograms per deciliter, consistent with thyrotoxicosis. Thyroid-stimulating antibodies were negative, and radioactive iodine uptake was suppressed, indicating hormone release rather than overproduction. The findings supported a diagnosis of subacute, painless thyroiditis. A new stage for seasoned actors, food anaphylaxis and the cystinyl leukotrienes, a clinical implications of basic research article by Joshua Boyce, from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston. Food allergies affect approximately 10% of children in the United States. Recent studies reveal a critical role for intestinally derived cystinyl leukotrienes in triggering food-induced anaphylaxis. These lipid mediators, produced by mast cells and epithelial cells, enhance allergen absorption through goblet cell-associated antigen passages and promote mucosal mast cell expansion. In mouse models, disrupting leukotriene metabolism or signaling protected against anaphylaxis triggered by oral but not systemic exposure to allergens. These findings underscore how local leukotriene activity in the gut influences systemic allergic responses. Although current leukotriene-targeting drugs have limitations, the research supports exploring broader inhibition strategies as preventive therapy for food allergy-related anaphylaxis. Why have we chosen not to fix primary care? The Vicious Cycle of Medical Hierarchy, a Medicine and Society article by Lisa Rosenbaum, a national correspondent for the Journal. Just 21% of graduates of primary care residencies are practicing in outpatient settings 3 to 5 years after graduation. Recognizing that practicing primary care full-time is essentially impossible, many PCPs have significantly reduced their clinical sessions. Primary care receives less than 5% of healthcare resources, despite accounting for about 35% of all U.S. healthcare visits. The great mystery of primary care, then, isn't how to make it better, but why have we chosen not to? Primary care is at the bottom of the totem pole. PCP's salaries reflect this hierarchy, and resource flow within institutions reinforces their status. Financial neglect begets further financial neglect. It's hardly intuitive that PCPs, who must know enough to manage most undifferentiated illness, should be valued the least. Yet, we're all acculturated into a belief system that elevates the specialist over the generalist and procedural over cognitive work. Though this hierarchy's subjective nature makes its validity impossible to assess, its entrenchment reflects an assumption that it's predetermined and impossible to change. The Relative Value Scale Update Committee, RUC, which updates physician reimbursement rates, has 32 voting members, only 5 of whom represent primary care fields, while the rest represent specialties. The resource-based relative value scale, created to narrow disparities, has instead institutionalized them, and the RUC's inadequacies reflect a deeper value system that must be reconsidered if primary care is to survive. Integration of tobacco cessation interventions into tuberculosis and HIV care, a perspective by Jonathan Shooter from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York. Tobacco use, tuberculosis, and HIV are among the leading causes of death globally, and the resulting syndemic has devastating effects, especially in low- and middle-income countries. Among people with HIV, research has found that tobacco use is responsible for more years of life lost than the virus itself. Integrating treatment for tobacco use into care for tuberculosis or HIV is not a new idea, but tobacco use continues to receive little attention in treatment guidelines. There is a dose-response effect for tobacco treatment, and behavioral therapy works better when it is paired with pharmacotherapy. Programs must be sensitive to stigma and delivered using non-judgmental approaches. Health systems can take several steps to integrate tobacco treatment into tuberculosis and HIV care, including training clinicians, tracking use, and promoting cessation through national policies. Clinicians and healthcare systems must meet patients where they are and be persistent in their efforts to help them stop using tobacco. Regulating corporate control in healthcare, Oregon's attempt to revive the CPOM doctrine, a perspective by Jane Zhu from Oregon Health and Science University, Portland, and Hayden Rook Lay from Brown University School of Public Health, Providence, Rhode Island. U.S. healthcare organizations are increasingly being bought and controlled by profit-seeking entities, a trend termed healthcare corporatization. Oregon's Senate Bill 951, signed into law in June 2025, addresses ownership structure directly, targeting a loophole in laws that ban corporate ownership of medical practices. Oregon's law focuses on corporate management services organizations, MSOs, which enter into contracts with physician practices to provide non-clinical administrative and other services, such as billing, marketing, and information technology services. The bill prohibits physicians with a financial interest in an MSO from owning a majority stake and requires that medical practices, not MSOs, retain de facto control over key decisions. Supporters believe corporate ownership has resulted in financial returns being prioritized over patient care. while critics warn it could disadvantage independent practices and accelerate the absorption of independent practices into hospitals. Moreover, the law doesn't apply to hospitals and other institutional facilities, which routinely exert control over clinical decisions, staffing, and resource allocation, drive price increases, and reduce competition by means of vertical and horizontal consolidation. Therefore, the law targets one form of corporate control while leaving another unchallenged. SB 951 offers a promising model for regulating corporate ownership, though its reach could be limited, and it may distort the competitive landscape in healthcare. Pistachio Ice Cream, a perspective by Biren Kamdar from the University of California, San Diego, La Jolla. What started as another week in the intensive care unit turned out to be a week all about ice cream. It started with Sally, a woman in her 60s admitted with shock and a painful sacral wound. This hospitalization was part of her larger battle with end-stage lung cancer, with diffuse metastases marbling her thoracic and lumbar vertebrae. Sally was in intractable pain, but was more concerned about being evicted from her assisted living facility for requiring more assistance than they could provide for her. Her spinal metastases had rendered her nearly unable to walk. Sally was sad. She was trapped in a hopeless situation. Suddenly, Dr. Kamdar's desire to lift her spirits overrode pressing to-do list items, such as discussing her code status. Dr. Kamdar asked the only question that seemed to make sense at the moment. Do you want some ice cream? Sitting up in excitement, she broke into a smile and said, yes. After some ice cream, Sally's voice grew stronger. She acknowledged that her final days were upon her, expressing a desire to spend those days pain-free in a peaceful place staffed by compassionate care providers. Next was Gustavo, who was not in the mood to talk about his impending death. Again, Dr. Kamdar asked the only question that seemed to make sense at the moment. ¿Quieres helado? Gustavo was offered pistachio ice cream and died comfortably the next morning, with family at his bedside. As patients brace for their final days, the simple act of pulling up a chair, connecting, and offering ice cream can be all it takes to bring clarity to complexity and outline realistic goals. In our images in clinical medicine, a 75-year-old woman with a history of breast cancer treated with mastectomy of both breasts and adjuvant hormonal therapy presented with a one-year history of a rash on her chest. A diagnosis of cutaneous metastases from breast carcinoma was made. In patients with a history of breast cancer, cutaneous metastases must be considered when a skin eruption resembling erysipelas or cellulitis occurs on the chest wall. In another image, a 26-year-old woman was referred to the pulmonary hypertension clinic with a 6-month history of exertional dyspnea and hoarseness. Vocal fold paralysis was seen on laryngoscopy, shown in a video at nejm.org. A diagnosis of Ortner's syndrome owing to pulmonary hypertension was made. Ortner's syndrome, also known as cardiovocal syndrome, occurs when the left recurrent laryngeal nerve is compressed between an enlarged cardiovascular structure, in this case the pulmonary artery, and the aortic arch. Hoarseness results from impaired innervation of the ipsilateral intrinsic muscles of the larynx. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.